If you try to think of computer scares from the year 2000, the first three characters that probably come to mind are Y2K. Everyone was worried about Y2K as we entered the year 2000, but it turned out to be a bit of a fizzer. When it comes to tech scares of the year 2000, the real star, however, was another virus known by the three words, I love you. The first headline-making global computer virus spread via an email with the subject line, I love you, and opening the attachment, which was titled Love Letter for You, copied the virus onto the victim's files and sent a new love letter to every contact in their Microsoft Outlook email address book. The love bug infected over 50 million people within 10 days. Take that, coronavirus. That is one hell of an infection curve. 20 years later, the person behind the online pandemic has finally admitted to writing and spreading the malware and explained why he did it. In his new book, Crime.com, From Viruses to Vote Rigging, How Hacking Went Global, investigative journalist Jeff White tells the story of how he tracked down the man behind the love bug. Jeff White, congratulations on the book, on finding the love bug, and thanks very much for joining us on Sunday Extra.
Thanks for having me.
For those of us who haven't got a love letter for a while in the virus sense, could you remind us just exactly what the impact and spread of the love bug was?
Yeah, it was quite astonishing. As you've said, you know, the big worry in the year 2000 was Y2K, the idea that computers would struggle with the shift from 1900s to 2000s. And then in May, you know, as we sort of breathed a sigh of relief having got through that, suddenly this virus just explodes around the world. I mean, I was working for an internet company at the time, and I remember just pandemonium in the office as person after person opened this damn letter up, got infected, and the IT guy literally running from desk to desk and shouting at people, stop opening, stop clicking on it. The interesting thing about it was, yes, people got infected with the love letter, but as you said, it copied itself when you got infected and sent copies of itself to everyone in your Microsoft Outlook address book. Now, if every person who got infected sent copies to 50 other people, and each of those 50 people sent copies to 50 people, it only takes six jumps for every single person in the world to be infected, assuming they had a computer. Which, if you think about it, that's, you know, that's an astonishing multiplication rate. So what happened is this email just started clogging up companies' email servers around the world that handle their email systems. So even if they hadn't got infections, companies were unplugging from the internet because they just didn't want to get overwhelmed. So the cost of the virus was partly obviously people getting infected, but it was also people trying really hard not to get infected and thereby, you know, shutting down their email system for days to try and stop getting affected by it. So it really was. It was the first sort of global pandemic computer virus that we had. And it really exposed how connected we all were at that point in time.
Was it particularly sophisticated coding, or was it groundbreaking just because it was the first to sort of try this thing?
On a code level, I think even the author would say it wasn't super, super advanced. What the guy did was took various components from viruses that already existed. So, the auto-spreading thing in Microsoft Outlook, that had been around for a while. The ability to infect and encrypt files, that had been around for a while. But he bundled it together. The true genius of the love bug wasn't the code. It was something far more important. It was, how do you trick people into doing something they shouldn't do, clicking on an email? And of course, this virus is going to go around the world, right? So it's going to have global appeal. You're going to try and trick people in every country under the sun into clicking on this email. What is the one thing that unites us all, that every human being wants? It's love. We all want
absolutely
love. And so that
and perhaps in 2000, we thought we might be able to get it through the internet and random emails.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. It was, you know, internet dating had just taken off. You know, the idea that people might be emailing you a love letter was, it was still fresh enough that it would work. You know, the important thing about this is good hackers don't just rely on code and kit. There's this idea of, well, hacking's all about, you know, tech. And yes, it is. But far more than that, if you're going to be a good hacker, you need to understand people, what they want, what they fear. And the love bug was absolutely at the heart of that.
Which brings us, of course, to the culprit behind the love bug. Presumably the search was intense back in 2000. Can you tell us how that search went and who was found by that search?
Yeah, well, one of the things that the email virus did was it stole people's passwords. And so it would send the passwords back to a computer server. And the computer server was tracked back to Manila in the Philippines. And then very quickly, they worked out who'd registered that account, and they ended up at an apartment in the capital of the Philippines. and they pulled in some people for questioning. The problem the police had was, at the time, there was no law against computer hacking in the Philippines. So there was a bizarre...
That's a hell of a loophole.
Yeah. And probably the people who were doing the hacking knew that only too well. So they had a bizarre press conference where they pulled in some of the suspects, but none of the suspects had anything to fear because they knew they couldn't be charged. And so there was just this huge question mark. You know, nobody's ever convicted. Nobody ever fessed up. And then, you know, the world moved on. You know, news moves on. And it had bugged me for 20 years since I first encountered the love bug, that no one had ever really been nailed for this. I thought it was worth chasing.
And indeed it was. But it is a funny search, isn't it? Because your searcher ultimately led you to one of the people who was, in fact, at that press conference and suspected of being the culprit. The press conference is still available to watch online, and it is a fascinating viewing. Perhaps you could now introduce us to the culprit and also tell us how you found him.
So the guy at the press conference was called Onel de Guzman. He was a computer science student at the time. So obviously, you know, he had the skills. And yeah, the press conference was, it was one of those moments where, you know, I'm a journalist, I respect my colleagues, but sometimes I just hate journalists because they don't ask the obvious question, like, did you do it? I think the closest anyone got at the press conference, they said, oh, did you release the virus maybe by accident? And Onel de Guzman sort of mumbled, oh, maybe. And then that was it. He just walked off.
It did seem that his English was a little limited, though. Was that the case?
Yes, that's what the impression was given in the press conference at the time. So I thought, okay, I'm going to track down Onel. He's clearly the key suspect. But also, a colleague of his, a guy called Michael Buen, was also named. And still to this day, if you read online, a lot of reports say, look, it was Onel de Guzman and this other guy, Michael Buen. Michael Buen's still around on the internet. He's still got a Twitter account, as far as I can work out. Onel de Guzman just vanished. And there were all these rumors. He'd been hired by Microsoft. He worked for the UN. And then one of the rumors said that a person on the internet said they'd seen him at a mobile phone stall at a particular market in the Philippines, in Manila. So I turn up at this market, and it's the classic Southeast Asian market. There were thousands of stalls. And I thought, well, I'll just find the mobile phone stall, and maybe Onel de Guzman will be there. And there's an entire section of this market that's just mobile phone stores. There's about 50 of them, all staffed, of course, by Filipino folks.
And so you had a bit of a haystack to try and find the needle in.
I'm against the wall in this market. It was hot as hell, and just thinking, well, I'm here now, so I'll just give it a go. So I wrote down his name on a piece of paper and just started showing it to people just at random. And this is the thing, you know, people talk about investigative journalists, and, you know, it sounds like a sort of highfalutin title. Often we're just the people who are desperate enough to do the thing that other people wouldn't bother doing.
I mean, as investigative techniques go, that's essentially a chauffeur at an airport holding up the card waiting for the person to come out.
Exactly. But the thing is, there's a certain amount of hubris attached to being an investigative journalist, because yes, you might just spend all afternoon, you know, on a wild goose chase, but if it works, you get a story. So I show his name to people. And of course, you know, I'm considerably taller and considerably paler than anybody else at this market. So I stand out like a sore thumb. I look like a tourist who's lost his kids. And eventually somebody says, oh yes, Onel, I know him. He used to work here. And he told me where he now works. And I went across town, another sort of shopping mall, another set of mobile phone stalls. Eventually I get pointed towards this stall, and there's a guy standing there, and this is fine. I can't believe I've managed to find this guy. And I tap him on the shoulder, and he turns around, and it's not him, but it's his colleague. And he says, yes, Onel de Guzman will be here tomorrow. You can come and speak to him. I said, what time does he turn up to work? He said, it's generally about 3 or 4 in the afternoon. It's a classic computer hacker, you know, works all night. And I thought, well, my flight is at 7 p.m., so I've got the narrowest window. So sure enough, I sat in the shopping mall. It was like the world's most boring stakeout. I sat in a shopping mall the next day for hours. He turns up, and I thought, well, he hasn't talked about this for 20 years. I've got to somehow convince him that now is the time to fess up. So I had all my evidence lined up of why it was him and all this kind of thing. And I thought, well, I'll just try and convince him to talk to me about it. And he just admitted it straight off, just off the bat, said, yes, it was me. Yeah. But no, he knew so much about the virus and how it worked. Yeah. It was undeniably him. And his explanation was that at the time, this was the era of dial-up internet, which, as young people will be bewildered to discover, you put the phone, you literally connected the phone to the internet and your computer to the phone.
I can hear the distinctive twang of the phone in my in my head.
Doink, doink. So, you know, you needed a password. You had to have a password to get online. And so an elder Gutsman didn't have the money to pay for these passwords, he claimed. So he thought, well, I'll steal them. But it's the classic hacker mentality where he was like, well, by stealing your password, I'm not depriving you of internet access. It's just we both get internet access.
So no global viruses so far. I mean, perhaps we can forgive him getting onto the internet, but what happened from there?
Yeah. He started stealing people's passwords in the Philippines. And so he would go on chat rooms and he would trick people into opening up a document. He'd pretend to be, you know, an attractive woman or attractive man. He would send them a link. They would click it and he would then hack their computer and get their password. And that worked out pretty well for him. But at some stage in 2000, he had this brainwave that rather than just hacking Filipino victims, he wanted to create something that would go worldwide. So he created this sort of self-spreading thing that would just run around the world stealing password upon password. And the bizarre thing is, you know, if he steals a password from someone in the US and tried to use it in the Philippines, it wouldn't have worked because it's a US password. Yeah. So quite what the logic of this was, I'm not sure. But the problem he had was, of course, when he pressed go on that initial email, when he found his first victim, from then on, there's no off switch. Mm. He had no control over it. And suddenly he starts getting reports of the fact. Basically, it's about 1 a.m. when he released the virus. He went out and got drunk with a mate of his, probably woke up with a hangover to discover that millions
he'd accidentally broken the internet around the world before that was a thing.
That's a bad hangover, isn't it? So, yes, and then he went to ground. He managed to sort of destroy his computer equipment or hide his computer equipment. And as I say, you know, no law against computer hacking in the Philippines. So he, in a way, got off scot-free. But, of course, you know, the internet never forgets. And, you know, someone like me with a bit of time and a bit of resources managed to track him down.
Indeed, amazing. We're speaking with Jeff White, author of Crime.com, From Viruses to Vote Rigging, How Hacking Went Global. And the very first time that a virus at least went global was the love bug. Jeff, what was the impact of this event on him? And what was his perspective on the event when some random investigative journalist walked into his mobile phone shop 20 years later?
Firstly, he's a fairly classic computer hacker. You know, having spoken to many of these people over the years, they're not the most sort of emotional or demonstrative people.
Fair play,
you know,
yes, yeah, yeah.
There were no tears and conniptions. He didn't throw anything at me.
Was there pride? Was there, like...
I think there was a sense of pride that he set out to create a virus that would work, and it did work. It's like somebody who, you know, who creates a machine gun, you know. Yes, it's going to be used for something, but your pride is in your work. So there's an element of that, I think. I think the troubling thing was I've spoken to some other people who are at the same computer college as him, and they've gone on to really good careers. I mean, these guys ended up working around the world. These folks ended up at different companies, you know, good careers. Arnelda Gutsman is working at a very small mobile phone stall in the back of a shopping mall. He claims he enjoys the work. You know, he does seem in his element. He's surrounded by disassembled mobile phones, but kind of get the feeling his life could have worked out very differently. Because, of course, after that, he never went back to school. And so his life sort of ended up in kind of a backwater. And this is a strange thing. I've met computer hackers who've gone to prison, come out of prison, and now have entire careers based on their former hacking job, you know,
Black
that they
used
to do.
White hat becomes white hat, yeah.
Exactly, you know, and this is bizarre sort of set of people who've demonstrably done something wrong and then sort of make a career out of it. And I sort of have mixed feelings about that. You know, on the other hand, there are people who, you know, make a lot of money, never get caught, make millions out of cybercrime. And those two types I can kind of understand. I think, you know, Arnelda Gutsman falls in an unhappy middle place where he's famous enough for the crime that he committed, but because he was never convicted for it, never did his time, he can't really make a career out of it because he'd have to then sort of admit it even more. So he's just ended up in this sort of strange middle point netherworld, really.
And is there any risk to him now by the fact that he's admitted being responsible for the love bug? Are any of those laws retrospective?
I would be surprised if there was any attempt to prosecute him. I think the authorities know where he is in the Philippines. Mm. I think he has actually had some dealings with the Filipino government, with local police. So, you know, he's not in hiding, in inverted commas. And I would be stunned after all this time if they could go after him. And also, I mean, he was a computer intrusion offence, or it would be classed as that now. But as you say, he didn't make any money out of it. So I would be stunned if he becomes a sort of target.
Thanks so much for joining us on Sunday Extra today.
Thanks so much for having me. Good to speak to you.
That was Jeff White, author of Crime.com, From Viruses to Vote Rigging, How Hacking Went Global. It's published in Australia by New South Books, and it'll be out next month, including many amazing stories like the story of the love bug.